you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This hour's top stories. Iraqis gather near Baghdad's airport to mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Supporters of the U.S. president gather in Oregon's capital Salem to protest against COVID-related lockdown measures. Thousands of people protest against the Israeli Prime Minister in Jerusalem al-Quds over his corruption and handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome to the program. Iraqis have marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. People in the Iraqi capital Baghdad held a candle vigil near the city's airport. A ceremony took place at the site of a drone attack that took the lives of General Soleimani and al-Muhandis last January. Earlier on Saturday, the Iraqi people also hit the streets of Baghdad to mourn the death of the two commanders. They chanted slogans demanding revenge for their killings. Iraqis or Iraqi demonstrators also renewed calls for the expulsion of U.S. forces from their country. Anti-American sentiments have been growing in Iraq since the U.S. killing of Soleimani and Muhandis. The spokesman for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says, U.S. and Israeli forces have remained on high alert since the assassination of General Soleimani.
An initial slap in the face of the enemy was Iran's missile strikes against the U.S.'s Ain al-Assad base in Iraq before General Soleimani was laid to rest. Ever since the operation, American and Israeli terrorist forces have remained on full alert. Military personnel know that the state of being on high alert means a slap in the face of the U.S.
The IRGC spokesman said Iran will pursue the U.S. assassination of Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis through legal channels in Iran and Iraq. Ramezan Sharif stressed that Iran reserves the right to take military revenge against the architects of the assassination and those who committed the crime. Iranian military commander Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi says General Soleimani had a leading role in creating stability and security in West Asia in recent years.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I offer my condolences to all Muslims.
This is IRIB English Radio from Tehran. We're now going over to Press TV headquarters here in Tehran for a special program on the occasion of the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, exactly a year ago. The top Iranian IRGC general, Qasem Soleimani, was martyred in a terrorist attack carried out in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad Airport in Iraq. Let's go over now to Press TV.
She is a professor of the University of Tehran. She joins us via Skype out of the Iranian capital. Madam, welcome. And also, I will have Honorable Tim Anderson. He's a director with Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies out of Sydney, Australia. He also joins us via Skype. Tim, I really appreciate your time with us again. Let's begin with Tehran and Professor Kat Khodai to give us her views as 1 year on since the assassination of General Soleimani. Please, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Well, I think maybe the most important thing you can say about this issue is the fact that the whole of this year has shown us the level of respect and love that people in Iran have for General Soleimani, showing, you know, the difference that you see in the way that he's portrayed in some Western media, the way that American propaganda wants people to see Qasem Soleimani, but his assassination.
Well, I believe we have momentarily lost Madame Kat Khodai. Instead, I'm going to pose the same question to Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson, if you hear me, please.
Yes, I think over the last year, we've seen a tremendous recognition of the role of both Commanders Mukhandas and Soleimani. They were both, of course, very famous in their own countries and in some of the neighboring countries, but now there is a very strong recognition at a global level of these two men, these two heroes, and their role. And I think there's been an educational process where people in different countries have learnt the role that both played in the eradication of the proxy terrorism that was being carried out by the US and its acolytes in the region. So there's a growing education of the profile and the meaning of the lives of these two men, and I think that's leading to the concept that there is really a school of thought, as the Iranian leader said. There is a university of the resistance, and there are great teachings to be imparted by the experiences of these two men.
Mr. Anderson, of course, a lot of people may argue. Let's just go back with the same question before I get back to you, Tim. Ms. Kat Khodai is back with us. Ms. Kat Khodai, I'm sorry, you just were coming in intermittently, momentarily. Mm-hmm. Let's just go back to the answer that you were giving to, you know, this year that has passed since the assassination of General Soleimani, please, again.
Yes, I was saying that the assassination demonstrated the level of love and respect that the Iranian people and, of course, the Iraqi people had for General Soleimani. I was stating that, you know, the way that the American media wants to portray him, this was completely different. And what the assassination demonstrated was that the way that he's viewed, the way that he's received inside Iran, inside the whole region, inside the Middle East, is completely different to the way that the Western propaganda wanted to portray him. So people loved him, people respected him, and they understood that he was someone fighting terrorism based on his own principles, based on an accepted morality. And I think that was what made him a kind of distinctive figure.
Tim, of course, like I was saying, a lot of people may argue that some of the policies that Iran was following, you know, depended greatly on the general. But, you know, it is something far from that. You know, the general spearheaded the Iranian campaign in bringing about, you know, the stability that the region needed, but it was not only limited to him. You know, what is your view on that? Do you really think that with killing characters as General Soleimani, you know, the perpetrators, the Americans, will really be able to do what they want? Or do you really think that the policies will continue no matter who's in place?
I don't think the Americans, that is to say the machine, you know, the military political establishment there, really believes that assassinating any general is going to change things substantially in their favor. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they had refrained from doing it up until Trump's move a year ago. And it was an idiosyncratic move, a cowardly and brutal crime. Because, as we know, General Soleimani was an invited guest and a respected guest in Iraq. It was a violation of Iraq's sovereignty. It helped mobilize the people of Iraq against the Americans for the first time in many years. So I don't think that the Americans really believe that, but they do through their arrogance, through the idea that they can do anything and get away from it and no one will carry out any sort of retribution. They are inclined to make these sorts of mistakes, and I think they have made a very big mistake here. They have built, indeed, I believe, the legend of Soleimani in particular, and it's something that's going to haunt them for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kat Khodai, what do you think about this? Do you really think that will, the assassination or, you know, heinous acts of crimes like that, will bring about any limitation to the Iranian agenda?
Well, first of all, the killing of General Soleimani was an act of terror. So that's that. The second fact is that, you know, Iran has been experiencing these types of terrorism from the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution. So I think this is important to have in mind, that from the very earliest decades of the revolution, what we had was that the MEK were carrying out acts of terrorism. You know, some very, very important, significant figures in Iran, like Ayatollah Beheshti, were assassinated with the hope of stopping this kind of march that the Iranian people had started towards their own independence. So the same way that the terrorist acts against people like Ayatollah Beheshti, other significant Iranian figures did not stop this kind of movement towards Iranian independence, I think the same goes for the terrorist act against Soleimani as well. So the whole thing, you know, you have a system in Iran. Iran has got a sophisticated military, political system that's not going to be stopped with a few acts like this, killing individuals. Of course, General Soleimani was a very significant figure. He had a lot of influence in the way that the Quds Force was acting, but certainly nothing is going to be stopped without him. Everything is just going to go on the way it was going before, even maybe stronger, because this act of terrorism has angered the Iranian people.
Uh-huh. Tim Anderson in Sydney, of course, there is something that we can definitely discuss, is the personal side of General Soleimani. He is an extremely popular character, not only in Iran, because he's Iranian, obviously, but in the whole region. If you have any information on that, or if you have taken any interest in reading about that or knowing, which I'm pretty sure, actually, you know, to some degree, I'm pretty sure that our viewers want to hear your account of the story.
Well, on his popularity, we know his popularity in Iran was measured. You know, there have been polls of Iranian people on lots of things, and there was a joint American-Iranian poll, I believe, just a year and a half ago, which showed before his assassination, which showed enormously high level of popularity there. His activities had been not well publicized until recent years. There were some interviews last year, for example, with Syed Hassan Nasrallah and General Soleimani about the operations in Lebanon in 2006, with the last Israeli invasion of Lebanon, for example. And the role was outlined there. And by the way, it's important to sort of reinforce that point that you mentioned before, that Soleimani, in that capacity, as in Syria, as in Palestine, as in Iraq, was acting as a servant of the Iranian system and as a conduit for the leader and for the political will of the Iranian Republic. So he was a particularly effective and well-loved personality in that respect. But I think his profile outside Iran wasn't as high before the assassination as it is now. That's why I'm saying, although there is a fair degree of counter-propaganda going on, precisely because the role of the Americans in the Middle East has been a deceptive one. You know, they've claimed they are there to fight Daesh, when in fact they were the masterminds of Daesh and al-Nusra, and of course the patrons of the MEK and so on. They are behind all of the significant terrorism in the region. But because they had to acknowledge the role of Soleimani in fighting that terrorism, a great degree of that is filtered out, and you'll find that there are these contradictions, a type of schizoid approach of, say, the Western media to the life and work of Soleimani. On the one hand, they are reflecting the anger and the jealousy that the Washington has towards the role of Soleimani. On the other hand, they are recognizing what everyone tells them, that he was the leading commander in the region that helped to bring about the destruction of Daesh, which was the largest terrorist group. So there's this sort of ambiguity, which is in many respects helping fuel the legend of Soleimani outside Iran, where he was less well known. And I think in the region it's true too, that his relationship, for example, with the leadership of the resistance in Lebanon, his personal relationship with the generals like General Issam Zahreddin in Syria, those sorts of things have been highlighted in the region. So I think since the assassination, the profile of of Commander Soleimani has risen substantially outside Iran.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a very nice point, actually. Professor Quatre-Deuil, do you get along with that? You know, he was quite a popular man, you know, before his assassination and martyrdom. Do you also get along with the fact that he became a much more a popular man, you know, after his assassination?
Yes, maybe the funeral itself was something that attracted a lot of attention. I mean, it was something that the whole machinery of Western propaganda could not deny. So people were seeing Iranians flocking to the streets to say their last goodbyes, their last farewell to the beloved general. But I still believe that the true personality, the true character of General Soleimani is not somehow known in the West. I believe that maybe his most important characteristic was the fact that he treated people as human beings. I think that's very important. So whether they are soldiers, whether they are religious people, whether they're ordinary people, if it's Iranians, Afghanis, if it's Iraqi people, Syrians, Lebanese, whatever type of people he's somehow kind of interacting with, the fact that he treats them as respectable human beings, and he devotes a lot of attention to them as human beings, not as people who are supposed to carry on his orders. I think this is what made him somehow, as Mr. Anderson mentioned, into a kind of a legend. Because nowadays we don't see this type of behavior very often. Specifically, we don't see it in a kind of, you know, Western models of political or military kind of command. We usually don't see these types of example. So I think this is what made him different. But I believe that still I don't agree that, you know, his true character is portrayed after his assassination, but I agree that, you know, the very fact that, you know, at least in the region people respected him and people loved him, this is something that the Western propaganda can't deny anymore.
I'm pretty sure that you also have some info about, you know, the fact that, you know, I'm just going to add this to what you said about why the man was so popular. It's sometimes, you know, people at that level are considered to be, you know, people who are walking around with a lot of bodyguards around them, you know, have a very luxurious way of life and things like that.
Yes.
You know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, that was not the case. That is also adding to the popularity of General Soleimani. You know, I remember a story of him where he, about 2-3 years ago, ordered some 36 bodyguards to be reduced only to 4. And, you know, he was traveling around the city, sometimes on a motorbike, when, you know, with some of the vehicles that had the least, safety standards. You know, such a man we were speaking about. Mr. Anderson, back to you. You, of course, pretty sure you have some idea of the security before General Soleimani in the Middle East region, and perhaps, you know, what is going to happen in terms of security after he's gone. Do you think, you know, in what way, let's just ask, in what way do you think this equation will be handled? Do you think that the Middle East, West Asia region, you know, the regions where General Soleimani wielded a lot of power, do you think, in what way do you think they're going to be affected now that he's gone?
Well, I think we should go back to the structures of the relations between the states in the region. We now have a very strong, for some years now, a strong military relationship between Iran, Iraq, and Syria, for example. And there have been some shows of that in recent times where they specifically put up this face, three faces, and then the role of Russia, which General Soleimani played a role in too. So the in other words, the face of the regional resistance and the forces that have been welded together effectively over those all of those years that Soleimani was at work, basically, that's coming to light. And I agree that there's a shallow in a lot of the media, there's a shallow portrayal of the real person, the personality there. But nevertheless, I'm thinking back now to some of the articles written by some of the military people in the US almost 10 years ago, where they themselves were fascinated because this was their rival, after all. This was a person who they had blamed for, pardon me, they had blamed for, example, mobilizing resistance in Iraq after the invasion of Iraq. And so they saw him as a rival, they saw him as an enemy, but they were also fascinated that he was a humble person. In a sense, he represented a different type of, a different model, which you do see in some other parts of the region. For example, in Syria, you have this tradition of frontline generals, people like, I come back to mentioning Issam Zahreddin, who was murdered in Deir Ezzor 3 years ago. The frontline general who fight there with their men and who are on the front line with ordinary people there. So some elements of that are coming through. But I think the structures set in place by Soleimani, the links across the region, the military cooperation, security cooperation, which of course creates a vessel for the development of infrastructural and economic cooperation in the region, which I believe is the next step and the next important step for security, basically. Because, of course, you know, the schemes of the enemy in the region for the last decade or more have been precisely to keep people divided and to keep people apart. And this is precisely where Soleimani, as a commander and as a trainer of commanders, was helping fuse that sort of process. He was training commanders for all his adult life, really. I mean, from a very young man in that war with Iraq, he was also training at that time. So he's left a huge legacy in other commanders with his presence, with his style, with lessons about the way he carried out his personal relationships and also the structures that are still in place there.
Professor Quatre-Deuil in Tehran, another issue regarding security. I'm pretty sure, and I want to make this bold a little bit. You know, we're talking about Iraq's security, you know, the general, of course, together with Abu Mahdi Mohandas and, you know, their comrades. They were like this glue that put the country, kept the country together in terms of its security in many, many of its upheavals after the occupation of, by the U.S. forces back in 2003. Many, many upheavals. I'm pretty sure you know. How do you evaluate this now, you know, with him gone? In what way? Or is there any way actually to predict, you know, security and, you know, what's going to become of it in Iraq, you know, and in what way do you think it'll turn?
Yeah, well, things in the Middle East are not usually predictable, but I think that if the legacy of General Soleimani is somehow adhered to, because I believe his legacy was based on strength, independence, and mutual cooperation in the region. So I believe that if this mutual cooperation, the fact that the countries in the region cooperate based not on selfish national interests, but on a certain level of respect towards each other, I think they are able to provide for their own security without the need to bring in foreign powers into our region. So I think if that legacy is paid attention to, and if the countries in the region decide to follow that successful example, you know, the defeat of Daesh was not something very, you know, it was a very kind of, I think, significant achievement which took place because of all these people, of all these countries deciding to respect each other and move towards mutual cooperation that would guarantee their security. So I think the same thing could follow, although you know, his assassination, his killing was a very big loss. I still believe that the countries are able to follow in his steps and still move towards this goal of a kind of security which is guaranteed by the countries, provided by the people in the region themselves. So, you know, you see all some countries, I don't know, these unfortunately, we have some leaders, some countries in our region having this belief that you have to somehow bring in someone from outside, which, of course, you know, these foreign powers are usually after, of course, always they're after their own self-interest in the region, which adds to the problems of the people here. So I think that, you know, about prediction, I think if this path is followed, I'm sure that countries like Iraq, together with Iran, together with other countries in the region, Syria, Lebanon, of course, they are able to move on towards providing security, providing a better life for their own people.
One last question for Mr. Anderson in Sydney. You tell us, please. You know, I've got about a minute for this, Tim. The aim, what was the aim? The aim was assassinating General Soleimani, or the aim was by assassinating him, probably, you know, trying to stop what he was after. Do you think, either case, do you think the Americans have reached that aim?
think there was a very vain hope that they would somehow decapitate, you know, the leadership of the regional resistance, which is what they fear most, what Washington and Tel Aviv fear most. They thought that perhaps it would disintegrate, it would fall into disorder. And I think also that Trump wanted some sort of scalp and to show some sort of vain achievement that he'd made when, in fact, he hadn't advanced the American agenda in the Middle East at all in his regime. I think they failed comprehensively in that, but it remains to be seen. Of course, the efforts have to be made to carry on the work and to learn the lessons from the tremendous legacy of Commanders Mohandas and Soleimani.
Many, many thanks. That's Tim Anderson, director with the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies out of Sydney, as well as the other guest I had, Madame Elham Khatrodai. She is a professor of with the University of Tehran out of the Iranian capital. With your comments, I really, really appreciate the time both of you gave us for this edition of the live coverage. I really appreciate it. You have a very good day. And viewers, of course, we're going to continue, you know, covering.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You're listening to IRB English Radio. We just had a special program, a roundtable discussion of the great martyred Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. This has been a special program by Press TV on the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the great Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. We now go back to our regular programming here on IRB English Radio. Stay with us.
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as U.S. President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor, Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to have a share of a few moments of your day as we reflect upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam in the form of everyday stories, stories regarding great personalities and figures, anecdotes, analogies. Because at the end of the day, we do what we can in order to find a glimpse of the light of truth in our lives. The story we're going to be discussing today is very similar to that of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, which we've talked about on our show, I think, on several occasions. So let's listen to the story real quick, and we'll see how this story is similar to that of the Prophet of God.
In the name of Allah, dear friends, so welcome to this program, Lantern. Today's story is entitled Feeling Pleased with Whatever Pleases Allah. One of the students of Sheikh Behjat, the great scholar, says, "One day I went to the house of Sheikh Behjat a few minutes before the start of the class because often the Sheikh used to attend the classroom. And he would narrate a story or a tradition or a moral lesson till all the students attend. Luckily, as I entered, he came to the room early and said this to me after the greeting and the salutation. In the city of Najaf, a handsome Iranian youth was with us from the people of Hamadan, and he was famous for being neat and physically well-formed. One day, this youth became paralyzed to the extent he could not walk except after leaning on a cane. I tried not to meet him due to his particular condition. Therefore, I used to avoid meeting him so I would not add one more grief to his griefs. One day, I got out of the alley and saw him standing in the street, so I had no choice except to meet him. Without contemplating, I asked him, 'How do you feel?' But I was upset with having said so and kept saying this to myself, 'What empty talk is this? Do you not see in what condition he is?' But contrary to my expectation, when he opened his mouth to answer my question, his speech was like cool water with which he put out what I had felt inside. He kept praising and thanking Allah with a spirit filled with activity and pleasure, as if he was drowned in blessings of Allah, the praise and the most exalted one. I felt relieved and my grief departed from me.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The story was regarding Ayatollah Behjet. Now, I don't personally know about the trials and turbulences and obstacles and difficulties Ayatollah Behjet went through in his life, though I'm pretty sure they weren't little, because anyone who gets anywhere in life has gotten there through trials and tests from Allah. And it is through those trials and tests that a man's true measure is revealed, and for ourselves most and foremost, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala already knows the quality of his servants and what they're made of, the extent of their spirit, their capacity. But if he does put us through tests, the tests are so that we prove something to ourselves, whether we can power through a certain situation, whether we can fight the obstacles, we can fight those battles, and we can stand tall at the end and step out of that storm as a better person. It all comes down to how we weather the storms of life. So the story was about a man who was known among his peers and his classmates as being very well dressed and, you know, being handsome and good looking and whatever. Some people are like that. Aside from being well dressed, you know, they have that thing going on with their natural appearance that is attractive, that looks, everything looks so well proportioned. And he was one of those individuals. And his test, ironically or naturally enough, was that he would be paralyzed. And which is something that we really need to focus on at some point as well. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, it seems that you get what you hate. That's what we usually talk, that's how we see it as, you know, simple-minded human beings. But from Allah's perspective, not that I am a professional at understanding Allah's perspective, but from what it seems is that you really do get what you hate, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants you to grow out of that. We are so keen on remaining in our comfort zones. But what we don't understand is that, as cliche as it may sound, unless we step out of that comfort zone, there is not going to be any growth for us. A child who learns how to ride the bike for the first time isn't feeling comfortable. A child who is weaned from his mother's, their mother's breast milk isn't comfortable. A child who is potty training isn't comfortable. I'm not comparing ourselves to a toddler, but I kind of am, because the foundation of our growth is set from our childhood. And by putting us through that process, it's like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to tell us that this is the condition to your growth. You have to step out of your comfort zone. You have to experiment things that you didn't even imagine you could do. A child cannot imagine themselves not living a single day without their mother's milk or without being able to go potty anywhere, anytime. The process of having to step into another room to do their business is so alien to them. When we grow up, sure, our lives become much, much, much like a million times more complicated than the process of, you know, call of nature. But the idea, the system is still the same, even if the scenario changes. So basically, through blessings, Allah wants to, just a quick wrap up, He wants us to grow. He wants us to get out of our comfort zone. He wants to encourage and motivate us. And He wants to raise awareness and consciousness within us through each blessing. Each blessing is a sign that is meant to lead us somewhere. And it is important for us to recognize what that sign is pointing toward. That's all the time that we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب
Selfie with Abu Mahdi. Abu Mahdi is a middle-aged Iraqi commander who is playing the most important role in the popular mobilization forces against Daesh terrorists. He's been among the people of his country fighting common threats for years. He fought against Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, the invaders of Iraq, and even the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization many years ago, and is now doing the same against Takfiri terrorists. Abu Mahdi is well-educated and fluent in several languages. He could have emigrated from Iraq along with his family for a while, just like many other elites, but he's never been such kind of a person. Abu Mahdi has great organizational skills. He's among the core members of the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. He is known as Muhandis, an Arabic term for engineer. The Iraqis mainly know him by his nickname, Abu Mahdi Muhandis.
We're here to purge the world of Takfiris and Ba'athists. We have come to this place to tell them we will never accept humiliation.
In this documentary, we will be with Abu Mahdi for 1 week. During all the years we've been filming the resistance front's operations in Syria and Iraq, we tried on several occasions to get in touch with the battle-hardened commander, but never with success. However, our perseverance and diligence paid off, and we finally managed to get closer to Abu Mahdi this time.
Peace be upon Abu Abdullah. Thanks to the blood of Imam Hussein and other martyrs, and also the month of Muharram, we are now on the entrance to the Al-Fatah region, north of Baiji.
This is my name, Jamal.
My name is Jamal Ibrahim. I'm a civil engineer, graduated from Baghdad Polytechnic University. I studied international relations for my MA in Tehran, and then I proceeded to a PhD.
The U.S. is afraid of the name of Abu Mahdi Muhandis and has blacklisted him. You've been designated a terrorist. Doesn't that bother you?
On the contrary, it's an honor for me. If I was on a U.S. white terror list, that would be a disaster. As Imam Khomeini said, America is Satan. It's our main enemy, worse than Israel. Now, if I am their enemy, that is excellent and a great point. I hope God won't take it back from me.
You speak Farsi better than we do.
Arabic is the language of the Quran, but Farsi is the language of the revolution. It's sweet. Martyr Muhammad Beheshti once said, learned Arabic, it's the language of Quran, and learned Farsi, as it's the language of the revolution.
Abu Mahdi meets with the army commanders on a daily basis. Among them are generals who might once have been trying to hunt him down under Saddam Hussein. But now the Iraqi dictator and his Ba'ath party are gone. Nowadays, Hadi Amiri and Abu Mahdi are not mere military commanders. They're the commanders of the hearts of the people living in the region.
I joined the Dawa Party in 1970. The Iraqi regime began to arrest Iraqi faithful clerics and the youth in 1973. Mr. Satt was the founder of the party. He wanted to establish a party along with a seminary to do works among people, cultural activities, not armed activities. All my comrades in the Dawa Party were arrested. Five senior Dawa figures were executed in 1975. It was a major crackdown until 1980, when Saj himself was finally executed. I and almost all of my friends used to frequently go to the neighborhoods and mosques back then. 95% of them in the Dawa Party were killed. I don't know how, but I and some of my friends managed to escape. We went to Kuwait and established the same party there and set up a fighting group. That's where we gradually started our armed activities. We were very active back then. The government of Kuwait was against us, against the people of Iran, the Shias of Iraq and Saddam Hussein. I got married in Kuwait and received a death sentence there as well. I went to Iran in 1984. I fled Kuwait and after crossing several countries, arrived in Tehran 3 or 4 months later.
Maybe these are the complexities of the war in Iraq that have made it unique and prolonged. When things go fine on the front line, the U.S. and its media start a propaganda war, saying the areas retaken from Daesh would see worse days as soon as the PMU forces arrive. If foreign sedition failed, it would be sowing discord inside that exposes the resistance front to dangers. The resistance forces are braced for the most critical operations. There are lots of difficulties in the war, but the U.S. direct and indirect interference in the war is the worst. The U.S. has stipulated that none of the PMU forces, which include different sects and ethnic groups in Iraq, is allowed to enter Fallujah. This comes as Iraq has its own official army, legitimate government, and administrative mechanism, but Washington doesn't want that.
What had you done that you were condemned to death in Kuwait?
Fighting activities, the same as Mustafa Badreddin was involved in. We were in the same group. He was a close friend of mine and was martyred recently. He was sent to jail for 7 years, but I managed to flee. After he was freed, we joined each other. We immediately joined the forces that were later renamed the Badr Brigades. After Ismail Daghayeri came in, the Ba'ath organization was set up. He was with us for 1 year and 10 months. He founded the organization that later turned into the brigades. He was our first martyr in Operation Karbala 5.
Abu Mahdi does not lead the operation from miles away. His war room is located in the armored vehicles near the front line. The children of the martyrs and his former comrades in arms constitute most of Abu Mahdi's bodyguards. These are young people who have devoted all their energy to protect Abu Mahdi's life. They shield Mohandas with their bodies from the deadly bullets of the snipers. Moreover, there are hundreds of suicide cars wandering around. If one of them makes its way to Abu Mahdi, his life will be in grave danger.
Oh,
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution said a meaningful thing after the imposed Iraqi war on Iran. He said the Badr Brigades would play a key role in Iraq's future. He said the sentence in 1990. That was a strange comment at that time. We wrote the sentence on a wall in our military base, but we asked ourselves, what role could the brigades play? The war was over, Saddam Hussein was in Iraq, and we were displaced. But now we see the role the Badr Brigades is playing. The most important commanders of the PMU are from the Badr Brigades. We set up the organization inside Iraq and began operations in the country. We were stationed in Talhor, then went to other provinces and made contacts with other fighters inside Iraq. Then we began different operations against the regime. Examples are targeting the presidential palace, targeting Saddam Hussein's son Uday. We undertook such operations.
Did you mount operations against the MKO in Iraq?
Yes, we did. The most important operation was in Badian Habib, after the martyrdom of Sayyad Shirazi. The MKO said 13 of their forces were killed. A complete building was exploded. Saddam Hussein was emboldened by U.S. support. Americans came to the conclusion that killing Saddam Hussein would serve their interests. They didn't free Iraq. See what they did in Iraq. They caused misery. Except for atomic bombs, they used every kind of weapons against the people of Iraq. We experienced lots of difficulties during more than a decade of sanctions against Iraq. The U.S. is our main enemy.
There could be partial victories against Takfiris using military operations and well-thought-out offensives. But to annihilate Takfiris, there is no way but a mutual engagement between all the forces. Iraq society is now moderate, but Shia and Sunni tribes and nomads still play a key role in the mobilization of people. This session is held upon Nomad Sheikh's request. They want to thank resistance fighters.
We came to these areas to defeat Daesh and free people from these Takfiri and terrorist ideas that have flourished with oil money. Saudi Arabia has lots of oil reserves. It sells 10 million barrels of oil per day, and the result has been the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Al-Zarqawi, and now Daesh. These are all two sides of the same coin. It's unfortunate that these factories and gardens got destroyed like that. They cannot be reconstructed even in a long time. We hope to succeed with the help of you, the people of this area. We normally don't stay for long in any area we enter, maximum 2 or 3 weeks. We hope it would take less than 3 weeks. We are guests here. We only plan to liberate the area and then we return. Your wives and families matter to us just like ours. Your money and your houses will remain safe. We need your cooperation. The U.S. plans to control the region by fanning the flames of tensions. I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but I feel the U.S. had a leading role in the creation of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and that is a fact. Now the U.S. is giving Al-Qaeda forces guidelines rather than trying to eliminate them. The things that happened in Syria, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and now in Iraq are being used by the U.S. Washington benefits from these ideas and groups. The U.S. is a great country, but it's a devil.
The PMU achieved more than expected. They retook large swaths of land from Daesh in the oil-rich provinces of Diyala and Salahuddin. Lots of refineries are also located in these two. The offensives dealt major blows to the Takfiris and made them fragile more than before.
What happened when you became the commander of the PMU in Iraq?
I don't know. It just happened. I worked and suddenly found out that had happened. The younger generation has to work. I am old. This is the convoy of youth. I am retired, but I am here.
How long have you been fighting?
If you mean armed fighting, I should say since 1983, which is 33 years, I think. If you mean generally since 1970, which means 46 years.
wishes for Abu Mahdi are full of fear and hope. I wish he would stay alive and fresh, but what deserves a fighter who has fought for over 30 years and has lost his friends one by one, more than martyrdom. Now I understand why Abu Mahdi doesn't reject any fighter's request for taking a photo with him. He takes selfies with everyone. He knows that death is just around the corner, either for him or the person standing next to him in the photo. It's been years that he is laughing at death. He takes photos with everyone and smiles at them.
Before the advent of Daesh, hundreds of people were being killed or injured each day, including me. In Karbala, on the way to Karbala, it's been happening for years. Things started in 2004 until 2014. They changed their name to Daesh in 2014 and reached Baghdad. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and others said they would head to Najaf and Karbala soon. They cursed Shias, Najaf, and Karbala until the time that the Marja issued a fatwa. Of course, we had begun the job before the fatwa. We created resistance organizations in 2003.
Fallujah was the most important city that fell to Daesh in winter 2014. There has been coordination between the Air Force, the police, the Army, the Task Force, and the PMU. This shows the public determination to wipe Daesh off Iraq.
The question now is why the PMU was created. Iraq has an army. Army soldiers could have gone to fight.
Take the case of Iraq's war against Iran. The army fought, but so did the people. They answered Imam's call and defended the revolution and the country's borders. They defended Islam. Why? Because they saw the scale of the invasion going beyond the capacity of the army. The West knew that we are Shias. We had the fatwa as well. They knew that without the help of the Islamic Revolution of Iran and without Iran leaders' fatwa, there couldn't have been any mobilization forces. The main idea is the religious and national side of the story. We want to defend our honor and our soil. We're confronting a huge invasion and a takfiri group called Daesh. We created the forces. It's true that we're Shias, but Sunnis joined us very soon. Based on the PMU charter, Sunnis should constitute 30% of all our forces. And they have reached that number, as we have 20,000 Sunni fighters. The PMU is comprised of Shias, Sunnis, Turkmen, Kurds. We even have Kurds, Yazidis, and Christians. You're actually the Iraqis. Some speak of tribes and sects. This is in their minds, and they're speaking against us.
One year ago, the war against Daesh in Iraq and Syria was disappointing and hard. Concentrating on land and resources, Daesh had a dream in mind: the creation of an independent and autonomous country. Al-Hasaka, Deir ez-Zor, and Raqqa in Syria, and Al-Anbar, Nineveh, and Saladin in Iraq, were the six provinces